Welcome to 21. I'm Drew Lasker. I'm a family man, professional athlete, and business owner of Train Harder 21 and 21 Media. Yvonne Harris and I have teamed up and created this podcast to explore the life lessons that come along with being an athlete. Why 21? It's my jersey number and a key part to my great fortune and career. So it seems fitting for this podcast.
Hi, I'm Yvonne Harris. I'm a proud boy mom and an advocate for efforts that improve the lives of women and children. Experiencing success as an athlete or in any facet of life does not happen by accident. There must be clarity, intention, and the willingness to pivot. Our guests on 21 share their journeys in ways that cause you to reflect, assess, and then take action. We are so thankful for the stories shared on this podcast because Drew and I know their wisdom shortens someone else's path to success. Enjoy this episode of 21.
Welcome back to another episode of 21. And like all of our guests, I'm always excited about who we bring in the room. And today's guest in particular, really excited because it's been a while since I got to catch up with my brother. But if you've been across the England shores, I'm sure you heard of this name, or if you've been really paying attention to the coaching circles in the NCAA, you've heard of this name. So I'm going to go ahead and bring him in the room. DeAntoine Cat Beasley. Cat, welcome to 21, my guy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, man. Thank you. I appreciate the introduction.
It's fitting, man, for sure. But before we dive into your story, we just want to break the ice a little bit with a game we call 21 Questions with 21. So we don't want you to overthink it. We're just going to fire a few questions at you, and you just give us the first answer that come to your head.
Okay.
All right. Whataburger or In-N-Out?
I go Whataburger. Spent a lot of time in Pensacola coaching, so Whataburger was good for me, especially late night.
Nike or Adidas?
Nike.
Beer or tequila?
Ooh, I'm going to go tequila.
Beach or mountains?
Beach.
Tupac or Biggie?
Ooh, I'm going to go Tupac.
Jordan or LeBron?
Jordan.
Better. Texans or Cowboys?
Oh, man. That's two bad options. I'm going to go.
I mean, Atlanta, the Falcons are right there in that same kind of region.
Two bad options, man. I'm going to go ahead and go Cowboys, I guess.
Popeyes or Chick-fil-A?
Ooh, Chick-fil-A.
Vegas or Miami?
Miami.
IHOP or Waffle House?
Waffle House. I'm from Atlanta. We got them on every corner.
East Coast or West Coast?
I think the West Coast fit my personality better. I haven't spent as much time there as the East Coast, but I go West Coast.
Early bird or night owl?
Early bird.
Grilled or fried?
Fried.
Car or truck?
Car.
Bluebell or Häagen-Dazs?
Bluebell.
Coke or Pepsi?
Coke.
Summer or winter?
Summer.
Xbox or PlayStation?
PlayStation.
Dishes or laundry?
Ooh, laundry.
City or country?
I'm a city boy. We'll go city.
And finally, obviously, being in that coaching lifestyle, you don't get a lot of time for it, but when you do, you going with the club or house party?
I think I'm house party. Now, I think my club days are few and far between. I think I'm house party now.
Is that because the bed is close?
For sure.
Cat, yeah. You are now off the hot seat.
Thank you.
For our listeners out there, just tell us a little bit about your background.
Like I said before, from Atlanta, Georgia, born and raised. Went to college in Tennessee, played at Tennessee Tech University. After college, went to China first and then went to England after that first summer. And was there for the Plymouth Raiders for 7 seasons. And then retired at the ripe age of 30 and got into coaching. Started off at Auburn University as a graduate assistant. Got my first full-time assistant job at my alma mater, Tennessee Tech. And I've been moving ever since. Went from Tennessee Tech to University of Tennessee Chattanooga. Left there, I was in junior college at Pensacola. Left there, I was at Gardner-Webb in North Carolina for 4 years. And then now at the University of Dayton.
Let's go back to the beginning. Talk to us about growing up in Atlanta. It's a great city. And what was the basketball scene like there?
As a high school player, it was, I guess it was starting to take shape. We had had some big time players come through. A couple years before me, Sharif Abdul-Rahim, who was in my county, was a big one that made it. And a guy named Dion Glover was in my class. They got drafted by the Hawks, a Georgia Tech player for 1 year. So it was starting to bubble. You know, Georgia has a, and Drew, you can relate to this, Georgia's kind of like Texas, football, football, football.
Right.
And as I was coming through, basketball was starting to take hold, and a lot of people putting a lot of emphasis on it. So starting to play AAU, I started late. So I didn't start playing really organized basketball until like eighth grade, I think. And then that summer was my first time playing AAU. So I started late, but the scene was good. It was great players all around. Competition was good. And it kind of helped made you elevate your play because you didn't want to be embarrassed. And that was at the time where you were playing it outside a lot. So I had my park that I played and represented at, and other places around the way had parks. And you would try to go throw five in a car and go take over someone else's park. And they were saying they were coming to our park next week. And so we were holding court at our park. So that's kind of where it got started. And then on to the high school level, you took that same mentality when you go to somebody else's gym and you want to have that respect. It was all about respect at that point and getting better and being the best in your area and then expanding into the best wherever, you know, locally. So
tell our listeners what high school you went to and what were some of the big name high schools in Atlanta at the time?
I went to South Cobb High School. Wheeler High School was big. That's where Sharif went and countless others. D.A. Lane, a couple of those guys went to school there. Dunwoody High School was big. I played them. I think they knocked us out of state tournament maybe my sophomore year, junior year. And they had, I mean, their starting five were all Division I guys. Started at Vanderbilt, Georgia. I think Richmond was like the smallest school that one of them went to, but they were like loaded. So that was another big program that kind of turned into a little bit of a dynasty along with Wheeler. So many. Even down south of the state, there was a lot of it. That was football country, but a lot of those guys, Mitchell Baker. You had Jermaine Jones, who played, got drafted by the 76ers, played at the University of Georgia. He was in our class as well that played. Mitchell Baker won a state championship. So it was the whole state was kind of bubbling at the same time with talent. And so we had our Georgia All-Star team. It was ridiculous. Saul Smith, who was at Kentucky, his dad, Tubby Smith, won a national championship as a first. So all of us were in the same class. And Scott Pullman started at Auburn, played at Auburn when they went to the Elite Eight, Final Four. It was just a lot of good players in that time and in the state. So it was a lot of fun.
And then how did you end up in Tennessee?
I actually went to Tennessee Tech for team camp. That's when team camps were really big. So my high school went there. A lot of teams from Georgia went to Tennessee Tech. They had a huge basketball camp for high schools in the summertime. So I was going there since my freshman year. So they had a chance to see me play every summer leading up. And I never thought I would go to school there. It's up in the mountains, and I'm a city boy. So I was like, no way I'm going here. But had some things that kind of went against me my senior year, and I didn't play. The second half of my senior year, I only played up until like a Christmas tournament. And then I didn't play after that. So my recruiting kind of disappeared a little bit. And I was going to go to junior college and ended up, they were loyal to me the whole time. I kind of respected that and ended up going there.
Are there any lessons in that moment that you would want to share to young student athletes?
Stay on top of everything. You have to be vigilant. Even at a young age, you kind of have to know everything that's around you, anything that can go wrong. Just be on top of things. And just because you're young is not an excuse. Your life can change very quickly at a young age. So there were some things that were out of my control, but there's some things I could have handled better as well in that time point that kind of took me on the path that I went on. But just stay vigilant and know that a mistake that you can make at a young age can affect you at an older age. So once you know better, you're not a kid, right? So take care of your business and focus in on all the details. And once you know where you want to go, take care of your business to get to that point.
So you landed at Tech and you were still focused on basketball, but now you have to get a little bit more focused on being a student too. So a lot of student athletes don't get that going in.
Right.
They don't understand the hard work, the hustle in being a student first and then an athlete. So talk to us about like your daily schedule, especially during the season. What was that like for you and how did you make it work?
Yeah, I think And being on the other side now, being a coach, I have the same spiel to students that I'm recruiting is the average student at a university has no idea what a student athlete go through, right? They think you're just going to practice and hanging out, but time management is key. So, you know, figuring out how to stay ahead of your work and your assignments and being organized, that's half the battle right there. No matter how smart you are, being organized and staying ahead and time management, because once you start traveling, you can get behind. And once you get behind in college, it just snowballs on you. So a normal day, let's say if you will practice, let's say it's afternoon practices. So you'll get up in the morning. I like early classes. So I would set my schedule. I wanted to be done by 11. So I have an 8 o'clock, a 9 o'clock, a 10 o'clock. And that gives me time to get something to eat, get some treatment, and then be at practice or film or whatever at 2 o'clock. So that would kind of start my day. After practice, you know, go 4:30. Maybe get some extra work after that. So you're looking at probably 6 o'clock by the time you're all said and done. So at 6 o'clock, you got to get you something to eat. And then if you didn't have your grades right, we had study hall. So we had study hall every night from 7 to 9. So you finish practice, you're leaving the gym around 6, 6:30. You rush to get something to eat, and then you get to study hall. You got study hall from 7 to 9. Now, once you got a high enough GPA, you can get out of study hall. So I made sure after my first year, I got out of study hall because I could do a lot between 7 and 9 and sit up in there doing study hall. So, but that was it. You get out of study hall at 9, get home, hang out with the team for a little bit and get ready to do it all over again. So it's not a whole lot of social time, really, especially during the season because you're traveling, practicing, you're lifting weights, eating, doing homework. So not a whole lot of spare time during the season, but that was kind of like a typical day.
To sum it up, basically, you're saying it's a grind.
It's definitely a grind, and you gotta love it, right? And that's why you see some people succeed with it. Some people just like, man, is it worth it? You know, you gotta really love it because you're sacrificing a lot, especially when you see your other buddies that aren't student athletes out partying and having a good time and doing all these things, and you know, you're not. You know, you're sacrificing. You're working out. You're keeping your body in shape. You can't put all the other stuff that they're putting their bodies in yours if you want to perform at a high level. So it is a sacrifice. But when you love it, you enjoy it.
Yeah. And it's tough at that college level. It's extremely tough to be successful. And even if you do all of the things that you mentioned, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to be great at that level. So there's so many barriers. And for you in particular, your sophomore year, you went through something. So just tell us about that experience, how that experience kind of shaped you today. And going through that time of adversity, who did you kind of lean on during that time?
So you're talking about my sophomore year. It was probably just after my birthday. So I just turned 20 years old and I noticed a lump in my neck. Didn't know what it was. Thought I might have got elbowed in practice or something like that. Just kept checking it out. Got the shower, whatever. What's that? So I went to the trainer. They had no idea what it was. So I continued to play during the season. And then I ended up going to a doctor. Now, this is 99. So cancer research has gone a long way from since then, and being in rural Tennessee, and the doctors had no idea. So they took a biopsy, sent it off somewhere, and I'm still playing. I finished the season out, basically. And so by the time I got some results, that they figured that it might be cancerous. I had completed my sophomore season, and I found a specialist back in Atlanta. I had an aunt that worked in a hospital, and so she got me in this private hospital that is a great hospital, and they had specialists in cancer that she had worked with a doctor that they referred me to, which was great. This guy had worked with, like, Braves. Andres Galarraga, I think, played for the Braves, had worked with him. So he's dealt with some high-up athletes, and he was real aggressive. He knew that I was athletic and young, and I told him, be as aggressive as you can be with me. So I was diagnosed with lymphoma after the season, so March of 99. So I came home, did chemotherapy. I stopped school right after the season and came home, did chemotherapy once every 2 weeks, which was a bear. That was tough, probably the toughest thing I had to do. And then after that, I wanted to get back to school. Like, I wanted to kind of get back and kind of be normal again. So I asked my oncologist if I could do the radiation portion of my treatment at Vanderbilt Hospital, if I can go back to school. I asked him, can I do it back in Tennessee? He's like, I don't know any places near where you go to school that I'm going to let you do this. Like, he said, but the Vanderbilt Hospital, they have a great program. So I'll let you go there. How far is that from you? I said, it's about an hour or so. He said, can you do it? Because radiation is every day. Well, Monday through Friday. Chemo is once every 2 weeks. Radiation Monday through Friday. He said, can you do it? I said, yeah, I can do it. I can do it. No problem. So after I went that whole, I think I went back to school the following fall. So September, started radiation at Vanderbilt Hospital. And so I was trying to catch up from the semester that I took off to come home. And then I wanted to get back on track. So I'm taking probably 22 hours of school and then going driving an hour to get radiation and then sitting in there getting bolted down and having that done to me and then driving back an hour and a half or so back to campus, doing my homework, going to practice just to watch and be around the guys and stuff like that. And did that until the following January. And then I was released. And so I started like sneaking back to practice, right? I started just standing around. Then I was passing. Then I was shooting on the side. And next thing you know, I'm jumping in a drill and all. So that kind of helped me get through it all, to be honest with you. To be as normal as I possibly could while going through that kind of kept me going. That was like, you know, having, you know how it is. You always say team is like family, right? And when you're away from your family, that really is your family. You spend all that time together. So all those guys treated me like normal, you know, joking with me. You know, I'm joking with them and hanging out. And so that whole thing, the coaches being supportive, that whole thing kind of got me through it and kept me focused on the end game, which was to beat the cancer and get back to doing what I love to do.
Let's go back to the health issue, Kat. How long was it from the time that you noticed the lump to the time that you went to the doctor?
It was probably about maybe 2 weeks, maybe two, three weeks.
Yeah, and has that really, I guess, inspired you even as a coach with your players? You're putting health first. I know you guys are elite athletes, but things still do happen, and you've got to pay attention to the weird things that may happen in your body.
Yeah, that definitely opened my eyes. You know how when you're an athlete, especially when you're young, you think you're invincible. Yeah, you really think you are. And so that changed my mindset for sure. I'm definitely more aware of my body and what it's telling me, and also try to relay that message to others as well.
And mental health is such a big topic now. And you got a lot of NBA players that's, you know, as of recently just have opened up about it. During that time when it wasn't really talked about, what was kind of your mental state when you were going during this time?
That's a great question, because I know that is a hot button topic right now. And it should be, I think, especially in our community, shed more light on being mentally healthy. And the things that we go through, like you said, for me, I never knew anything about, you know, mental health or anything like that, especially at that age. But the one thing that I knew is that what I wanted to do, and I wasn't ready to leave. And I'm pretty stubborn. So I just basically would do things in my mind to help me get through. So I told myself I would never throw up. You know, they're pumping this poison in me for chemotherapy. I'm not going to throw up. Like, you don't do it. You know, you don't show the cancer any weakness. So I went this whole time, I never threw up, right? It's just little things that I would do to myself to keep me focused on beating it. That first week, it was every 2 weeks. So that first week of chemotherapy, I would be wiped. And I don't really know how to explain it. I'll give you an example, though. One time, the doctor said, hey, the first couple treatments, you'll be okay probably, but then it's going to really hit you. You'll understand. I'm like, I'm tough. You know, it ain't gonna hit me. So I got home, drove myself to the appointment back home, and I'm back, and it just hit me. So I'm sitting here, and I got the remote. I'm laying on the bed. I got the remote here on the nightstand, and I'm so tired that I can't get the remote to turn the TV off. I just went to sleep and just left everything on. That's how wow. tired I was. And that's the only way I can kind of give you an example of how much it like really wipes you. And so that would hit me on week one. Week two, I would kind of be getting back to normal. So I would on week two, I would try to do everything that I would normally do. I would go to the mall. I would go to the park and shoot some shots. I would go hang out with a friend. So, you know, I would try to be really, really normal. One time spring breaking in Florida. I was supposed to, but doctor told me not to be in direct sunlight, but everybody was gone and it was my off week of chemo. So I went, you know, and it kept me normal and it kept me not feeling like the sick kid. You know, I didn't really tell anybody that I had cancer because I didn't want everybody being, you know, pity. Yeah, I wanted people to treat me as normal as possible. So if you weren't in my inner circle, you had no idea that I had it, right? So that's kind of how I liked it. On that off week, be as normal as possible. That week with chemo, you fight, you attack, and you get through it. And that's kind of, I just kept it really small like that all the way through.
And when you're going through adversity, it's always about like those small wins. And for you, I'm sure you was motivated to get back to what you do, and that's playing basketball. So obviously you redshirted and you come back for your junior and senior seasons, leading the Golden Eagles to OVC titles in 2001-2002, including the 27-7 campaign as a senior, in which you led Tennessee Tech to earn an NIT over Georgia Tech, Dayton, ironically, and Yale. Yeah. And when you hear that, thinking about all the things that you went through previously, what did that success mean to you?
It was awesome, right? Because that was my end goal. And to be honest with you, I didn't start. I played a lot of minutes, but I didn't start before the cancer. So coming out of the cancer, I didn't want to be like, hey, he went through cancer and he's on like a cheerleader or something. Like, I wanted to be a contributor. Like, I wanted to play and I wanted to start. Like, I wanted to be a big time contributor on the team. I knew we had a chance to be good, and I wanted to be a part of why we were good. And so that was my whole mindset, not to just come back and sit on the end of the bench and cheer. I wanted to like contribute. So that was my mindset. And so I started probably working out probably before I should have, and because I had a goal in mind. And so being able to see it come full circle and start on those two teams and captain those two teams that were the best. My senior year was the best season that the school ever had, and to be a part of that and that run we had in NIT, I thought we were going to the NCAA tournament. We ran through the conference and lost in at that level, the mid-major level, you got to win your conference tournament to get to the NCAA tournament. You don't have an automatic bid. We ran through the league. I think we lost one game, and then we lost buzzer beater, Murray State. That ball sat in the air for like 2 minutes, it seemed like. But we lost and didn't get to the NCAA tournament. And then we got an NIT and made a run and won three games in NIT. And it was like the craziest ride ever. Like, we had people busing to go watch us play on the other side of the country, and following us everywhere. So it was amazing to be a part of it. And like you said, that going through what I went through just kind of made it feel that much sweeter. In the end, and getting the chance to accomplish the goals and beat cancer, and then B, get back to doing what I love to do and play at a high level and contribute and have fun with the group of guys that kind of helped me get through it. It was the best experience, really.
I mean, that's inspiring. And not only did you get to enjoy the team success, but also you had some individual success as you received the Sam Harley Lynn Award for your contributions at Tennessee Tech, and the Golden Eagle Award for sacrifice, dedication, and hard work, and also the John P. Hendricks Leadership Award, in which you won twice, which today the only student athlete in Tennessee Tech history to win all three awards. I mean, what does that mean to you, man?
I don't know. It's some of those things that may not mean a lot to a lot of people, but it means a lot to me because it shows that my peers respected how I approached it. They respected how I worked. They knew they could depend on me, which is always big for me. My teammates know that they can rely on me. It was great, man. I didn't know that. I didn't know I was the only one to ever receive those awards, both of those awards, so two times. So that's good. That's good. I mean, I don't know. Anytime you get awards, it's great. But when it comes from the standpoint of your peers thinking that you work hard and you're reliable and they trust you, and it's a respect thing for me. It goes back to that. So no, it's great.
And one thing that I hear now, playing, in this league 16 years and at 38, Ooh. Is people always say that, yeah, I know, woof, my legs don't like it. But, people always say, that I'm professional. And, I got a lot of that from you, just watching you from afar, during those early days, because that's one thing that you were always about. Like, you were just always about your business. You were always professional the way you handled yourself. And obviously you won before I got there, and we had an opportunity to win a trophy in Plymouth when I got there, which is still the only trophy to date in 2007. But just for the people in Plymouth who might be listening, just what did that time down in Plymouth, how did that shape you? What did it mean to you? What does the city mean to you? All those things.
Man, it was, first of all, thanks for saying that. But it was Plymouth, like I said, it was a perfect place for me to have my professional career. I met people there that I consider family, the Views family, like family to be. I call them my English family. But, I try to get back there, you know, once a year, and I go stay with those guys for about 3 days. That's about as much as I can stand them. No, just kidding. But I stay with those guys for a few days, and being in Plymouth is like, I don't know, those people just really love basketball. They love the Raiders, I should say. And it seems weird because it's not a big city. It's not London. Yes. It's not Manchester, right? It's not Birmingham, but it's, they love and support the Raiders. So we never went to a home game where there wasn't a packed house, right? And that just gets you going. That makes you want to play hard. That makes you want to give everything you have, because those people could be doing anything else, right? It's not like basketball is the highest rated sport in England, right? But they came every home game and they supported every home game. And it was like, you give everything you want. And that's all you want as a player. You want people to respect what you do, right? You want people to enjoy coming to watch you play and do your job at the highest level and respect what you're doing. And they did it every home game. They did it. And we had a group that would travel to every away game, right?
Every game.
So, every game. So the love that they had for what we did was, you know, we all know people that play in other places in England for sure, because we play on the road and you're like, there's nobody in here. But other countries and, you know, all your friends and buddies that you have, and they talk about their experiences, and it was nothing like mine, right? You know, the people love it. We go anywhere, go to a grocery store, go in, and people want to see what you're doing, what you're buying, talk about this and that. And so it was nothing but love for me the whole time I was there. And I know a lot of people can't say that. So it was a great experience for me.
For you, Kat, during your time in Plymouth, you were obviously a multi-season all-star and MVP. How did your game evolve from your rookie season to your seventh year? And then kind of talk us through that transition in your last season, if it was planned or just when you went into retirement and obviously you went back into coaching back into the States.
My game, I think, like I said, naturally, I'm probably more of a playmaker than a scorer. And when I first got to Plymouth, they weren't in the BBL. They were in the league below, the EBL. So we were only allowed two Americans at the time. And so I remember this, to kind of let you know how it was. We played someone, I think it was Oxford or someone like that. And I had, you know, I used to try to fill the stat sheets. I had maybe 14, 15 points, 8 boards, 7 assists, 3 blocks, 3 steals. Like, so that's what I was shooting for, right? I want to pad the stats. And we beat them, right? And apparently they had been losing to them recently, but we beat them. So I'm excited. I'm like, yeah, man, that's, you know, this is good. And they were like, you know, one of the owners and stuff, and the coach, Gary, kind of called me to the side. I was like, hey, I'm like, you know, I'm thinking they about to say, hey, you know, you did a great job. They were like, you got to look to score more. Like, you got to score more points. You got to, like, I know these guys are, you know, they're happy that you're giving them the ball, but you got to look to score more. You got to put, I'm like, oh, all right. So, like, I hadn't changed my mindset of being a playmaker only until, like, hey, you got to go ahead and get some buckets and then fill the rest of your stat sheet, right? So it made me more of a more aggressive scorer, I would say. My game changed a little bit. Now, when we moved to the BBL and we were allowed more Americans and we had more talent around, then I was able to kind of go back into my natural position of scoring when I needed to, but facilitating as well. I was more of a slasher and really athletic my first couple of years there. And then by the time I left, you know, I was, you know, mid post turnaround jump shot, pull up jump shot. The pull up became my best tool. The pull up became my best tool. It's something I didn't really have in college. And I kind of worked and developed it in my early years in Plymouth. And that became my go to. And if I needed a bucket, I knew I can get one and get a clean look with my pull up jump shot.
If we fast forward to 2009, or was it 2010? We get to the point 2009, where, you know, for every athlete, you know, it's inevitable when the ball starts bouncing and then you retire from the Plymouth Raiders in professional basketball. Had you been thinking about retirement that year? Or how did that, talk us kind of through that process?
Obviously for you, the ball is just going to keep bouncing, but
it's slowing down. I'm pushing it.
I don't know. You know how when you turn 30, you start thinking. You just start thinking a lot. And I had just turned 30 that year and just start thinking. Like, I got to that point where I was going to either do what you're doing and just keep playing for the next, you know, I was going to play 15 years, 16 years. That was my goal, because I was going to keep myself in good shape and keep playing. Or I was going to get into coaching, which I always wanted to do, right? I was at that crossroad of, I can't keep passing up on. I won't get a lot of opportunities coaching if I'm out of for 10 years. Like, they're going to be like, where have you been? Like, you don't know any kids. How can you recruit? You know, so I was getting to that point. So after that season in 2009, my coach that I played for at Tennessee Tech was the head coach at Auburn. And he hit me and said, hey, man, I'm looking for a graduate assistant. If you want to come and learn the business from the ground up, I'd love to have you on my staff. And I was like, oh, man, like, he's at Auburn. If I don't go now, when would I get this opportunity again? It was like, if I didn't have that in, I'm not sure if I would have done it. But he approached me with that, and things were changing at the Raiders. Ownership was changing. If you remember that year, everything was kind of changing a little bit that year. So those two things combined with me turning 30 kind of opened up the door. So what I didn't realize, I told my coach, okay, you know, I think I'm going to do it. And he said, all right. Then he told me, hey, you got to get your master's. Like, you got to take the GRE. And I was like, GRE? I hadn't been in the classroom in 8 years. I don't know. So I had to, now I'm nervous, right? So, but I managed to score high enough on the GRE. And I remember being in Dubai. My wife and I, we were dating at the time, but we wanted to go to Dubai. So we went to Dubai, and I'm over there studying for the GRE because I'm going to come back and move back to the States and try to get into grad school at Auburn. So that was that time, and I'm glad I did it. It was times where I was, you know, I obviously missed playing because I love it. There's nothing I'd rather do than play basketball. But that opportunity, and it's something I always wanted to do. I always wanted to coach. And, you know, I was player coach with the Raiders, and I had coached Mar Johns while I was there in Plymouth as well. So I always wanted to get into it, and that was just a perfect opportunity for me to kind of get in and learn the business and get with somebody that I knew and trusted as well. So that was kind of the door opening for me to kind of move to my next phase in life, I guess you could say.
And for our listeners out there, just quickly walk us through your coaching journey. You obviously started as a GA at Auburn, and then where'd you go from there?
Yes, GA at Auburn at the ripe age of 30. Most GAs are fresh out of college, 22 years old, and I'm 30 and taking orders and doing all the grunt work, which humbled me a lot.
Before you go on, talk to us about your graduate degree. That was probably the best part of that experience, right?
Well, I was going to get to that, but I did the first year, and it was in higher education and sports management, minor in sports management. It was really cool. I had professors, actually the president of the university taught one of my classes, and a lot of the athletic directors were in a few of my classes as well. So it was great learning experience, great hands-on stuff. I learned a lot about how the behind the scenes of athletics work. But after my first year, our coaching staff was fired. I got a baptism of what happens in the life of a coach my first year, right? So my boss was fired. I'm left there. I have no idea what to do. I've got to find a job, or do I stay on there and try to land with the new coaching staff? So I talked to the new coach when he came in, and he kind of had some people in play. He didn't really want anybody from the old staff around, to be honest with you. And I kind of needed to get into recruiting as well, because I was behind the eight ball. Now I'm 31. I hadn't recruited a high school kid yet. So I went to junior college after that. So I only finished 1 year of my master's, and I ended up going to junior college as an assistant coach. Right after that, I went to Pensacola State, and I was there for about 3 months, and I got my first full-time job at Tennessee Tech. So I went Auburn as a GA, full-time junior college assistant, traveling all over. We had to sign like 11 kids. So it was like baptism by fire with recruiting, right? So now I'm like traveling all over the country, driving, trying to see these kids, recruit 11 kids. And by the time we got the class in, I got a full-time assistant job at my alma mater, which was awesome. A lot of people that were there when I played were still there. A lot of professors that I had would come over to the office. It was like one of those full circle things.
That's
right?
Cool. So
it was a great experience. Like you said, having people around that, you know, the guy that recruited me there was still around in as an athletic director. And so it was just people around that knew me as a player and got a chance to know me as an adult. It was a great experience. So that was good. And I left there and went to UT Chattanooga. The head coach there was an assistant that I played for. It was one of the closest assistants that I was to, a great friend of mine. And he talked me into coming down there. So it was tough for me to leave Tennessee Tech. But he was there, and two guys that I played with at Tennessee Tech were assistants on his staff. So it was kind of like leaving family to go with the family that I actually played with and coached, played for. So that made that journey a little bit easier. It was a bigger market, bigger, better facilities, better conference. So it was a good move for me in the coaching ranks. And we left there, staff got fired there. And if a lot of people that don't know, when your head coach gets fired, everybody's fired, basically. So
everybody.
So you gotta, you know, stay in. So I went back to junior college for a year, which was a great experience. I worked for a great guy there, recruited some big time Division I talent that just had to go junior college. And it was a different experience for me, learning how to deal with different kids from different backgrounds. And we won there, their first panhandle title in like, I don't know, 20 years. So it was a great experience there. Then I went to Gardner Webb. The head coach at Gardner Webb was an assistant at Auburn when I was a GA there. So that's how I met him. And so once he got the head job, he was like, man, once I got an opportunity, I was going to hire you. So he brought me on and I worked for him. We had success there for 4 years. And this is where it kind of turns a little different. I took the job here at University of Dayton, and it's on the women's side. So I had never coached girls, never recruited women, had never even thought about it really. And a friend of mine who was at an opposing school in our conference, we talked all the time about scouting and recruiting and stuff. And he said, hey, man, I just got off the phone with my friend that was a head coach at University of Dayton on the women's side. I said, man, you thinking about going on the women's side? He said, nah, I told her to call you. I was like, what? He was like, yeah, she's going to call you tonight. I'm like, why? What did you say? He's like, hey, I know you wanted to change. I was like, yeah, but I was thinking, you know, what I'm used to type thing. And so she called and we talked philosophy. And I was really trying to like get her not to hire me. You know, I was just like, you sure you want to do this? Like, I've never recruited on the women's side before. I don't know how. I've never coached a woman. I don't know. You know, this is out of, you know, uncharted territory for me. And she said, well, you know, if you're a good person and you work hard, you'll be okay. And I was in line with another men's job at the exact same time. So it was one that was a step up from where I was. And they said, I interviewed on that Monday for the men's job, interviewed on Tuesday, Wednesday here at Dayton for the women's job. And at the weekend, I had to decide what I wanted to do. And surprised me, but I really liked it when I was here and got a chance to meet everyone, and it made a lot of sense. And I had just had a daughter too, and I think that kind of played a role in it as well. And I decided to come here. And so this is my third year here, and it's been great. Had success. They've had success before I got here, and last year had success and qualified for the NCAA tournament for the won the regular season, losing one conference game, and then won the conference tournament. So we qualified for the NCAA tournament, but due to COVID, didn't get a chance to play in it. But it's been a good time since I've been here, for sure.
So as a recruiter of both men and women athletes, gender aside, what are some of the common success factors when you're going to recruit? What are you looking for and saying, okay, that's the athlete I want on my team?
It will vary because you're recruiting to a certain system and recruiting for a certain head coach. Some head coaches are a certain way. Some head coaches are different. So you always got to recruit to your head coach's temperament and what they like. But for me, one thing that stands out is I think it was a given before, but now hustle is like a skill. You know, working hard is a skill. And before it was like price of admission, but now it's not. So I really look for that. I look for little things like interaction on the bench, and when your coach takes you out, how you interact, and when someone on your team messes up, how you interact with them. I look at those little things because that usually tells me what type of person you really are. You can tell me how nice you are, and your coach can tell me how nice of a kid you are and all this stuff. But those type of things kind of stand out to me. But how they fit in our system is a big thing. No matter how talented a kid is, if they don't fit what you do, it's not going to be good for either of you, right? You're going to try to make them into something that they're not. They're going to get frustrated. They're going to end up leaving, to be honest with you. So recruit to the system and then trust your eyes, right? So if you see something, you got to trust it. You can't go by what a recruiting service list tells you. This kid is ranked 58, right? But if you see something there that says she won't be successful, he won't be successful in what you do, then you have to let that pass. Don't waste their time or your time. Just go on to get something that kind of fits your system and your culture. I think those things always win out. I think we can get fooled by talent as a coach, and talent is key. You need it. But you can kind of give a little bit of talent for those other things, like how they work and how they fit your system and what you like to do. So,
but you mentioned that you didn't have any experience in the women's game. And for me, in 2003, I got a unique opportunity. So I was a junior in college. And a lot of people don't know this, but that summer I trained with the women's Olympic team for a whole week, which was the first time. I knew about women's basketball because obviously we had a women's team. But my experience with those ladies for a week changed my perspective about women's basketball forever, because those girls were so good. I'm talking about like Sue Bird, Cheryl Swoops, Tina Thompson. For you, had your perspective changed with the women's game since you've been involved in it?
It has. And I think I have respect for it, because when I was younger, I talked about pro-am before, and I used to go and watch pro-am basketball. That's your pros that come back home and play on teams in the summer. And that was a woman named Teresa Edwards. You talk about Olympics. She's like a four-time gold medalist or whatever. She would kill guys in the summertime. And I would be like, you see what she did? Like, good player. I'm like, you see what she's doing to these? And I had never seen that before. And I, you know, at Run and Shoot, I had watched women work out before WNBA was taking off. A guy that was kind of running it for the pro that let me play with those guys was training people. He was on Inside Stuff, training a woman that for the WNBA and stuff. So I had been around really, really high level women basketball players. So I had a respect for it, but I didn't know what it would be like at the college level. So it opened my eyes a lot, because I hadn't watched a ton of collegiate women's basketball. I watched Tennessee Vols. Being in Tennessee, Tennessee women's basketball was huge. And a teammate of mine, sister, played on some of those really good teams. She's now actually the head coach at Tennessee. So Kelly Harper. So getting a chance to watch them, but I hadn't seen it on a grand scale of a lot of other teams. So it's been eye opening for me, and some of the skill level at some of these women. And I was like, whoa, okay. Now this is what we're looking for. Okay. I can deal with this. So I don't know if I could, and this is a pretty, Dayton's at a good level as far as basketball. Went to the Elite Eight, you know, maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago. Had, you know, in the last 6 years, had three WNBA draft picks. So it's a high level of basketball. And so if I would have, I don't know if I could have taken a job on the women's side at a really, really low level. I don't know if it would have been the same for me experience-wise. But this experience has been really good. We recruit really good players, high-level players, and they compete. They work hard. They train hard. And the biggest thing, and people ask me all the time the difference between men and women's, a freshman – and on the men's side, they're like a sponge. They're like, yeah, coach, you know. And they all men think they're going to the NBA, by the way. So they all, no matter what school I've been at, they all thought they were going to the NBA. But by the time they're juniors, they know it all for the most part. They're not really, hey, coach, I know, you know. Women, like, we got fifth-year seniors, and they're like, want drill work, skill work. Coach, what about this footwork? You know, it's like they're more of a sponge than they – and so I really, that to me, that excites me, because I can see them improving, and all the things that we're working on when they implement it, and the joy that they get from it gives me that joy to kind of continue doing it. So that's the biggest difference that I noticed from coaching Division I men's basketball to women's, is that they love to be coached.
Kat, from your experience, how do you see the game differently as a coach than you did as a player?
I think the one thing that most people thought I would be a decent coach, and one of the reasons why I like coaching is I kind of viewed the game as a coach, as a player. I kind of saw the game almost as a coach while I was playing. But I think now as a coach, you kind of have a more of a holistic view of everything. So just the breaking down of your opponent is key. Like, I take a lot of pride in being able to know everything that this opponent wants to do to beat us, and being able to counter that. So the scouting part of it for me is the part that kind of keeps me engaged. And obviously the skill development and practice is good. The recruiting is good too. It can get old at times when you're on the road for a long time, driving and flying all over the place to see kids. But that part of scouting, being detail oriented and trying to figure out the best way to put your team in a position to be successful is the part that I really enjoy right now.
Who are some of the coaches and players you admire now, or maybe admired growing up?
Growing up was Coach K for me. I love Duke. When I was young, a lot of my friends could not stand Duke, and they all, you know, they like Carolina and all those places, and they don't know why I like Duke. But I thought Coach K was great at the time, but I think he's even better now because he's one of the few coaches that has been able to change through the time. Like, he's coached for a long time, and right, the kids he's coaching now is nowhere near the kids he was coaching when he had Bobby Hurley and Grant Hill, right? It's totally different eras. And he's coached through them all and coached the USA team with LeBron and Kobe, and those guys respect him. Like, he's coached it at every level of player through all these, you know, the last three decades, and it remained at the top. So he's one of the guys that I probably admired the most, I would say.
And players you admire?
My favorite player was obviously Michael Jordan, but Kobe Bryant was my recent around my era, player that I liked, just because he had the ability that I didn't have as far as scoring the ball the way he did. But I thought my approach was like his, as far as, you know, doing whatever it takes to win the game and, you know, working hard and competing and just doing whatever it takes to win. So I he was the guy that I looked to, just because of his mentality, and do whatever it takes to win. I appreciate that. That killer instinct that he had was something that, to me, no one could rival but Michael Jordan. And something that is missing in a lot of players, but he had it in spades. So he was my favorite by far.
If you can go back to your Hotlanta days and speak to a younger D'Antoine Beasley, what advice would you give yourself, man?
I don't know. That's a great question. I would say be open. I think I got more open-minded about things. Probably the cancer thing probably started me to open my eyes to more things about health and all those other things, and being grateful. I was always, I guess, grateful, but not taking things for granted, like life or being here next year, you know, those type of things. So I think the cancer started that for me. So before the cancer, I would say be more open, experience things, be more worldly. Just try to be, like I said, more open to everything, not just with basketball and the people in that circle, but people outside of that circle and getting to know people and being more aware of things. So I think before the cancer, the young D'Antoine in the city of Atlanta was aware of the city life, but not much outside of the city life. So I would say be more open to experience different experiences for sure.
And speaking on that, the experience you went through, you know, having cancer and beating cancer, I'm pretty sure like now you live more in the now, but what's next for you?
That's a great question. I don't know. Coaching is kind of consuming, all consuming, especially during the season. You don't really have time to think about much, but I think eventually I want to become a head coach at some point. And I'm a little different. I know some guys like, I want to coach at North Carolina. And I kind of want to be at a place where I can do it my way, the way I want to do it, and build something. So I want to kind of start to be a head coach at a lower level and kind of build something. And then if it goes to something else, then we'll take it there. But I kind of – every job is not a great job. I've learned that through experience, but and also through talking to others. And I just want to go to a place where, obviously, my family will like being there. And so a good place to live. But a place where I can – it don't have to be the highest of levels. I just want to be in charge of a place and build a culture and see all these ideas that I have and suggestions that I have, if they all play out. You know, because when you're an assistant, you make suggestions and your head coach can use them. Or they can use some of the suggestion or part of the suggestion, part of the idea. But I want to see if all the ideas and suggestions and the things that I've learned through the years, if I can build my own culture and program. And I would love to have a shot at that at some point.
We'll be believing that for you, and we'll be rooting for you as well.
Right. And finally, when you do, if you're prepping for a game or whatever you like to do in your spare time, what's on your playlist when you get in the zone? Is it Lil Jon, or have you graduated from those days?
I was just thinking that, Drew. There's got to be some ATL crunk music in here. Don't let us down, Kat.
Hey, I always go back to it. It depends, right? And so when I'm into it and really trying to figure it out, and I want to have the juices flowing, I put on the early 2000s, late 90s Southern hip hop. So it's gonna have some Lil Jon.
Yeah.
It's gonna have some Outkast. An 8 Ball and MJG and
yes sir,
you know, and UGK and all. It's gonna have some of that South flavor of the late 90s, early 2000s. But when I really want to focus in, I really like old school R&B. So it's gonna have some Anita Baker on there, or some Freddie Jackson or Luther Vandross. You know, I'm gonna have Sade and all that running through there, and that just relaxes me and allows me to kind of hone in on what I'm doing. So it depends on what I'm trying to get after. But the music is key. You know, that sets the tone for everything I'm doing.
I didn't see that coming, but that was nice.
I have an old soul, so.
This was great, Cap. We really appreciate your time, man. And love hearing your story. It's amazing, and you keep doing amazing. That's who you are.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity. Again, always good to see Drew. It's been too long, so we got to try to catch up one of these times we come over to England. I'm usually rushing around, but I know you got Callie Hearn, Charlie close in age. Well, Callie just turned 4, right?
Yep. They close.
Yeah, they're close in age, and I'm sure they both got – I know mine got a lot of attitude, so.
Mine got attitude and energy, so.
Yes. They let you know how old you are because you can't keep up, man. It's oozing out of them. So we got to link up. But it's always great to touch base with you. And I keep up from afar. I like all the stuff you're doing. With the train harder and you know, when you go back home and keep them kids involved, and it starts with the grassroots, man. So getting the skill level started with the young kids is key to keeping the game growing. So I admire that and the family man that you are.
But yeah, man, thank you. We know that your schedule, you know, in that coaching business is extremely busy. So we appreciate you taking time to spend with us, man. It's been great catching up you know, keep doing your thing. We'll keep following you, and we'll pray for that head coaching job someday.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Yvonne. Great to meet you, and I appreciate it. Good luck to you guys the rest of the season, Drew, and thanks so much for the opportunity. I've enjoyed tonight.
Thanks to everyone for tuning in. To the athletes, keep being the best you can be. Run your race with excellence. To the parents of athletes, let's continue to support our children with patience, grace, and understanding, learning to recognize how to truly become the guides and the stewards that we are supposed to be. To everyone, be willing to share your experiences to help others along their paths, and always be open to the wisdom that comes your way.
For more information about the 21 Podcast, 21 Media, and services provided by Train Harder 21, visit the website at drewlasker.com. And follow us across all social media platforms. Remember to add this podcast to your playlist, subscribe, rate, and review. Until next episode of 21, train harder.